I am really looking forward to this guest today. He's coming all the way from New Milford. That's almost to the New York state line, north of Danbury today. His name is Joe Hurley, and he has written a fantastic book called 10 Million Steps on Route 6. He basically hoofed it on foot from Provincetown to Los Angeles on Route 6. The subtitle of the book is A Fresh Look at America and Americans from Cape Cod to California. Joe, this is tremendous. Tell me how the concept of this book came about.
Well, actually, the concept started when I was working as a reporter for the News Times in Danbury. And I was looking at a map once, and I started seeing some of these towns on the eastern side of the state that not only had I never would never be able to give directions to, I wouldn't even know they're in Connecticut.
Much the same way that people here don't know much about New Milford.
Exactly. I found that out later. But I thought, you know, it'd be a good service to our readers to actually discover some of these towns, and I thought the best way to do it would be to walk across the state. As it turns out, Route 6 cuts across the state and ends in our hometown of Danbury. So we decided to do that. I walked with the photographer, and we did it in a week, 120 miles in 6 days. And people loved the story. The editors loved the story. The circulation spiked. It was great. People were patting us on the back. And, you know, wow, you walked 120 miles? And then same week, I looked at the wire service, and there was this grandmother walking from Texas to Washington, D.C., which put 120 miles a little bit into perspective. And that was actually the start of this longer walk across the U.S., because I was looking at a map again. I was just wondering where Route 6 went. And I checked to the east, and I said, wow, this little two-lane road in Connecticut goes all the way to Cape Cod. I thought that was pretty remarkable. And then I went to the west, and it just kept going and going and going, like the Energizer Bunny, until it got to California.
Well, I think a lot of people, when they think of cross-country routes, the old routes before the interstate system, they think of Route 66. So is there, can you compare and contrast Route 6 to Route 66?
Well, Route 66 is certainly much more famous. It had its own television program, if you're really old like Wayne.
And its own song, too.
And its own song. So people know that. They, as a matter of fact, they think when we talk about Route 6, they think we're talking about Route 66. The two roads actually cross each other twice, but Route 6 is, back in the days, back in the 30s, Route 6 was the more famous road. It was the first coast-to-coast highway. It was the longest road in the country, and it is still the longest continuous highway in the country. So, and that's why the Grand Army of the Republic, which was a fairly strong group back then, lobbied to have their name attached to the road.
Because which it is here in Connecticut, and you mentioned in the book, what is it, 14 states have some reference to GAR highway?
Oh, yeah, it is GAR all across the road. And in fact, Route 6 stops when you enter California. There's a whole story behind that. But you can go beyond Route 6, and you will still see signs that say GAR highway. So GAR may go coast to coast.
Now, I do want to hear about how Route 6 stopped, and it's kind of been restarted again in California. I lived in L.A., and I didn't know those were Route 6, but I came here, and, of course, Route 6 is one of the primary routes across the state. What were the rules you set for the coast-to-coast walk? Obviously, you're not walking 24-7, so you get to a certain town. Are you planning ahead and saying, okay, motel there, or is it a RV type of thing? How did you work out things like sleeping arrangements along the route?
The logistics, sure. To do the walk, you needed a photographer. The photographer that I had worked with at crossing Connecticut wasn't going to be available. He actually had to work. I had retired. That was the reason I could do this. I was trying to find a photographer, and it's, for some strange reason, it was a little difficult to find somebody who would take 9 months off their life for no salary and go across the country. I needed them to do the driving and to do the logistics that you were talking about. And the way it worked out is I finally got somebody, Travis Lindhorst, who takes great pictures. That's what we needed him for, too. He would drop me off in the morning at a certain spot and then pick me up 20 miles later. Which worked out pretty well most of the time. And we stay. He would line up hotels, motels, wherever we stayed, people's houses. We only stayed on the road once, and that was only because it was in a very remote part of Nevada.
On the road, meaning you slept near the highway?
We slept in the vehicle, yeah, because it would have been. These are places where it's 120 miles between towns, so.
Is this before the Geo Metro died?
Yes, as a matter. Well, actually, but we didn't. That's the reason I said vehicle, is we rented a van so that we could sleep in that, and then we came back and picked up the Geo after.
Well, there's a story about that, about how the Geo Metro almost made it to L.A. and
yes.
then it died. What happened?
It died.
is it still there?
We don't know. It was actually me being a little bit, shall we say, frugal. The car had a problem in western Colorado, and we could have done a big fix on it and cost, I don't know, a couple $100s and take some time, or we could have just taken our chances and with a little fix. We did the little fix, and it didn't quite make it. Yeah.
Joe, my listeners know that I've traveled a lot, both around the country as well as around the world, but I've also driven cross-country twice and a third time from San Antonio to L.A., and with all the traveling you do by air and occasionally by train, things like that, driving is a whole other experience. You see the country that you don't see from the more modern, faster ways of doing it. And I got to think that you've taken that to a new level now where you're seeing it on foot. You are really getting up close and personal to what the USA is all about. Do you have a new appreciation for this country now, having walked coast to coast?
Yes, for the country and the people. In the car, as you said, you get to see things, places that you would never see on the highway, and it's a whole different experience. What you get from walking is the people. You get to meet people, and you get to there are a zillion stories in here, and many more that we never even got into the book of Americans.
Now, you indicated that Travis, the photographer, he was behind you in a vehicle. Does that mean that a lot of this 3,600-mile walk is done solo, by yourself, or did you have partners? Did you have people to talk with during these day-long walks?
Well, first of all, it's a little bit of a stretch to say he was behind me in the car, because he would drop me off, and I wouldn't see him a lot of days.
He'd go off and take pictures of the little
boy. He was a 20-something guy. He's not going to be sitting in the car waiting for me. He had things to do.
So are you walking solo?
Yes, I was by myself, except generally, well, one of the ways we funded the walk was I wrote stories for a dozen newspapers. And when we came into towns where the newspapers said, where those newspapers were, or where other radio stations, TV stations, or newspapers had covered us, we'd get a lot of people coming out and visiting us and that sort of thing. Otherwise, it was me.
What did Mrs. Hurley think about losing you from those months of March to December of 2004? You call home a lot?
Well, yeah, I made it a point to call home every day. She got a little bit suckered into it because I had said, long before, I had said, I'm going to walk across the country maybe next year or so. And she said, oh, yeah, sure, go ahead. And and I said again, I really think I'm walking across. She didn't believe me. And then at one point I said, I'm going to walk across the country starting in March. And she said, what? And, but it was locked in by that point. So she got a little hooked into it. One of the things, I always say her job was harder than mine. Because, I'd be out there every day and people would be patting me on the back. Great job, Joe. You're really doing something great, great. She's at home. Nobody's supporting her. Nobody's patting her on the back. And she's doing my job and her job and, making things go right and not getting any of the attention or credit.
How much weight did you lose on this trek?
Well, when I play basketball or something approximating basketball.
Yes, still you do.
Well, the knees are starting to go. One of the guys in basketball said, Joe, you're going to be able to eat whatever you want, and you're going to lose lots of weight on this walk. So I followed his advice, and I ate everything I could get my hands on for the first month or two of the walk. And surprisingly, I didn't lose any weight at all. I said, what's going on here? And then I realized, maybe I should cut down to just eating normally. And then I was losing about a pound a week, and I actually had to try to keep the weight up.
10 million steps, 3,600 miles. What was your average mileage per day?
I tried to do 20 miles a day. We usually did at least that. Toward the end, the last month, the last several weeks, I wanted to make it to L.A. at a certain time, or actually to Long Beach at a certain time. So I was actually picked it up. I was probably doing about 20, 25 miles.
Long Beach, hypothetically, is the end of Route 6, right?
Yes.
Hypothetically.
Hypothetically.
If I drive around Long Beach, California today, will I see a sign that says I'm on Route 6?
You will not see a sign that says you're on Route 6 unless they're starting to put historic 6 signs in California. But when you get right to almost to the ocean in Route 6, there is a plaque that says the historic end of Route 6.
This is from preservationists who are trying to bring back history? They're doing the same thing.
I think that plaque has been there since forever.
They're trying to do the same thing as 66 also, trying to keep that as a historical relic of an old classic highway, too, I think, too. How do people get a copy of this book?
They can do it several ways. They can go to the website, which is route6walk.com, R-O-U-T-E, number 6walk.com, and order it through that. They can contact me personally. I live in New Milford, Connecticut. I'm in the phone book, and you may or may not give out the phone number. It's up to you.
354-1389.
They can email me, japhurley, H-U-R-L-E-Y, at Hotmail. You'll get it cheaper if you contact me directly.
It began in 2004 in Provincetown, Massachusetts. What were your thoughts on Provincetown?
Excuse me. The main thing was not just Provincetown, but the Cape as a whole in winter. It's just a different place. Being from Boston originally and living in Connecticut, my wife loving the ocean, we spent a number of days, weeks, weekends on the Cape. But it's just a totally different animal in winter. You can go to Provincetown and actually, walk in the streets without seeing anybody. There's hardly any restaurants open. I was thinking for a long time that this must have been the way the Cape was 100 years ago, with few people and just you and the ocean. I met with somebody on the Cape not long ago, and they said, "No, not really. 100 years ago, in winter, there were more people in Provincetown than there are now. It was a year-round community."
I didn't notice any pictures in the book of the nude beaches up there, though. Is that coming in your second book?
Yeah, you have to be in the picture, though.
On second thought, let's not have a second edition. Although, you got stuff that didn't make it in this book. Might there be a second edition down the road?
I'd like to sell the first edition first.
How's that working out?
It's good. We printed 1,000 copies. We've sold about 500. I need to sell 600 to pay for the printing costs and another 100 to pay for everything else. So at 700, we break even. We're doing well. The only thing now is, in the beginning, for several months, the book was just selling itself. All I had to do was ship it out. Now I actually have to promote it, which is fun.
Here's the thing, Joe. To me, when people see the book, when they get their hands on it, like they can do coming up at the events you've got here locally in the next couple of weeks, but when they get their hands on it and see not just the text and the type of stories with, by the way, a sense of humor. Mm-hmm. You're not writing some serious thing here. There's like a little attitude about this with a tongue-in-cheek thing. I enjoyed the humor that you had in it. But I think when they see it and the incredible pictures across the nation on Route 6, doesn't the book almost sell itself?
It does, when people see it. That's my job now, is to get people to see it. You mentioned the tongue-in-cheek. A lot of people think that this is another one of those books about people walking across the country, which are some fine books. Walk Across America, which I purposely did not read before this because I didn't want to imitate it. But really, my model for this was Charles Carroll and his little snippets.
On the road?
Yeah, on the road.
Concept, yeah. You, actually, at one point in the Cape Cod part, you talked about Route 6A. Is there a difference between Route 6 and Route 6A on the Cape?
On the Cape, there sure is. Route 6 is the one everybody knows, that the highway that goes down the center of the Cape. Route 6A is actually the longest historic district in the country. It's filled with all kinds of little shops and things like that. It's not the quickest road, as is the case in so many places on Route 6, but it is the best road.
You talked about walking in the wintertime on the Cape. You began in March of 2004 on this cross-country walk. Were there some weather issues you had, either in New England or elsewhere, that made the walk difficult? Maybe you had to stop for a day and let a storm pass?
Never stopped for a day or anything like that on the weather. The first month, until we got to Connecticut, really, it was very, very much rain. The thing that stopped me in Pennsylvania almost was that I stepped on, I was taking a shower, I stepped out of the shower and directly onto my belt buckle with a prong sticking up. It was very bloody. It hit bone, in fact. Of course, at the bottom of your foot, not very deep to hit bone, but I thought that might be the end of the trip right there. And I walked for a few days, and if you recall, I forget, Schilling, the bloody sock.
Yeah, yeah.
That was me walking on Route 6 for a few days. And a little bit of a funny story. There was a place in Pennsylvania, a small town, and my sock was absolutely full of blood, and I needed to do something. So I went into this little drugstore, bought some Band-Aids and bandages and stuff, and sat down in the floor in the store and changed my shoe and put all that stuff on. I'm sure that the store owner was really thrilled to have me there.
The pictures and the stories just jump off the page at you, and it's not just a matter of the towns that you visited, like Eastham on the Cape, Orleans, but like in Hyannis, you talk to ferry captain Brian O'Malley, and you talk about the islands and going beyond places like Oak Bluffs and seeing Gay Head and Menemsha and areas like that on Martha's Vineyard, which I've done many times, and you're absolutely right. Yarmouth Port, Fairhaven. You get to New Bedford, Massachusetts, and you tell the story of the Witch of Wall Street. Who's the Witch of Wall Street?
Oh, why did you have to ask me that? I forget her name now. You tell me.
Edith Nichols as Hetty Green, a.k.a.
Okay.
The Witch of Wall Street.
Yeah, Hetty Green. It's a great little story. First of all, they have this...
That answers the question why I asked it.
Yes. there's a very nice and big museum in New Bedford, Whaling Museum, and worth a visit in itself. Across the street was this little shop with Edith Nichols portraying Hetty Green, and she was, a century ago, she was as famous as Martha Stewart. She just accumulated money.
Did she go to
money.
Jail?
No, but there were a lot of people who wanted to put her there. I think the thing that brings it up to modern times is she was a woman in the business world, and that was not acceptable at those times. So that's where she was doing the same thing as men were doing, but because she was a woman, she got called a witch.
She was very successful at what she did.
Oh,
too.
She was very successful. She bought after the Chicago fire, she bought a lot of downtown Chicago. And kept it. She would buy things. When she bought things, she didn't turn them over. She kept them. She owned Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco, that sort of thing. Mm.
Now, was it around New Bedford or maybe in the Connecticut? At what point, Joe, did you think, what was I thinking? I mean, this is a pretty ambitious expedition. Now, you've already done a cross-Connecticut walk before this, so you know what it's like more than most. But is there some point when you're walking coast to coast, you leave Provincetown, you're going through Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, is there some point early on when you're thinking, oh, my God?
Yeah, first day.
The first day?
Yes.
What about the second and third days?
it continued. The first day is kind of like when you're out doing some kind of physical exercise and you start and you get that first, you didn't get your wind yet and say, oh my gosh, I don't think I can make it through this. Well, that was the first day. The legs hurt. And I'm saying, this is the first day. I can't make this thing. It hurts already. So, the legs are always sore after that.
When you're going to walk 3,600 miles cross country, do you do pre-walk conditioning both before you leave Provincetown on day one, but also each morning before you start walking, little warm-up exercises?
I did stretching each morning, just as prudent. In terms of preparing, I had probably walked 100 miles in a week. I spent several months doing that. I've run marathon in my life, so I know you build up gradually. But the thing is, you can't in any way prepare for walking several months at 20 miles a day. There's no way, unless you're going to do it, and then you're probably risking getting yourself hurt preparing. So you just have to take your chances.
Was there a point, maybe on those hills of Iowa, which, as you wrote in the book, who knew Iowa had hills?
Yeah.
But was there a point when the body starts to fight back and says, hey, I can't keep doing this?
The time that I remember most was actually the last week. I was pretty broken down by then. And here we are.
Well, you've come through Mojave and Death Valley and areas like that, too.
Yeah, and now we're going from L.A. to Long Beach. It should be a piece of cake. But every day in that last week, I was wondering whether I was going to make it through that day, which is, sounds kind of strange. And you know in your head, look, if I have to crawl, I'm going to get there. But there were points where I was thinking, well, I may have to crawl.
You talked about the first couple of days after Provincetown that you started getting aches and pains, and obviously 20 miles a day will do that to you. But was there a point where those muscles began to get loose, and after a while, fourth, fifth, second week, whatever the case is, that those didn't bother you as much as they did the first couple of days?
I think the pain and the discomfort, if I were a doctor, I'd say discomfort, is always there. I think you get used to it more, but I think it's always there.
What's the This Land Is Your Land connection to this book?
It just epitomizes what the book is about, the stretching across the country. He says it much more poetically than I do, but I got a lot more stories than he does. So,
and you basically do it chronologically, going from one part of the country across to the western part of the country as well. And at these talks that you give, you have an entire presentation, and you brought some of the show-and-tell things on your presentation. And I think one of the most important things you brought along that you can show to the people, it's in your book too, but a bigger version, is a map. Not everyone's done the Route 6 walk that you've done, so this gives them a perception of what Route 6 is all about, right?
Yes. I found that people really are interested in the map, so I use it both. At Lebanon, it'll be a craft fair, so I won't be doing the presentation, but the map will be out there, and some of the pictures will be out there. The thing that you're looking at now is a list of all the stories. That's a little different, because what we do on the when I do an actual presentation, which I call Behind the Scenes of 10 Million Steps, the book and the walk, is I loan people a copy of the book, and we all go through the book together as sort of a virtual walk across the country. And it really works well, because people like to be able to see the context of what I'm talking about. And they can see the pictures. And one of the problems we had was that we'd have the book in front of us, and I'd say, okay, people turn to page 137. Well, people would be fumbling around, and it would take several minutes to get to the right page and the right story, and inevitably somebody would be looking over to them, what page did he say, etc. So I made up these little posters with the stories and the numbers with them, so that it's kind of like being in church and you see the song and the number, and that works very well.
We'll now read from page 343. So, and here, you want to just there's a pictorial thing. A lot of these are from the book. Oh, I enjoyed this one here. Tell me about this picture here that was in the book. Now, if you didn't know the context, you've got to explain what this is. The sign says Grand Army of the Republic Highway, Route 6 East, Provincetown, Mass. But the key to this big green street sign here, the highway sign, 3,205 miles. This Route 6 East of Provincetown sign, where is this located?
That's located in Bishop, California, just over the line in California where the modern end of Route 6. I did not stop there. I walked the old Route 6 out to the coast. But it's a great sign, and they used to have one in Provincetown, too. But they stopped putting them there because they kept getting stolen. I guess people out west are more honest, although that's an awfully big one there in California. A little hard to steal that one. Although I went to Provincetown doing a program about a month ago, and there's a new sign up there. They've decided to put them back up.
Now, so what's the destination point? Is it Bishop, California, Long Beach? What does it say, Route 6 to where?
I'm not sure. I would imagine it's to Bishop, probably with the same number. I hope the same number. That's 3,205 miles, and then you tack on the rest for the old Route 6. It comes out to about 3,500 miles, roughly, although I could never get a real... there's no consensus on exactly how long Route 6 is. We just know it's one of the longest continuous road in the country.
Now, this picture I'm pointing at here, tell me the scene where we're talking. It looks like somewhere in California. And then tell me about who's walking here.
Oh, you got a great eye. That is in California.
I'm from California.
Yeah.
I've been there.
And it's actually outside a little town that is owned by the Indian tribe. I think it's the something Shoshone. And they have a little gas station and diner, and that's their town. And and they own it, and it sustains their tribe a little bit. They have a school there, too, and this is a woman who's loved the remoteness of that area, and she decided to walk with me. I think she walked with me most of the day with that little kid, which is, you know, a number of hours.
Looks on the cool side, too. You're both bundled up a little bit.
Oh,
she's
yeah.
got a knit hat on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And she's got the kid in a stroller,
yeah.
walking down this expanse of what I guess is desert, and then behind it, the mountains just sort of take off, and there's actually some clouds near the top of the mountain.
Yeah.
How about this scene here? What is this, Colorado?
Oh, that's one of my, when people ask me my favorite places, this is always in the top two or three. This is Glenwood Canyon in Colorado.
Yeah.
Can't see it on radio, of course, but there's a, the road, it's a last stretch of interstate done, and they took so long doing it because they had to figure out a way to put the road in there while preserving the canyon. And as you're walking into it, you go from the mountain, from the Rockies, and the road kind of flattens out, and then it goes down into this wonderful, wonderful canyon. There's a Colorado River going next to it. And on the other side, you can't really see it unless it's brought to your attention, is some railroad tracks. And the California Zephyr, twice a day, goes over those railroad tracks.
Over here on the left, is that the railroad tracks?
Yeah,
they're kind of hidden in some growth there.
But
I love the way that this interstate highway in the middle of this canyon, it's like an interstate in the middle of the Grand Canyon. It's not quite as big as the Grand Canyon. But you not only have this highway that is on these supports that go up above the trees and so forth with a canyon wall right next to that, but the reflection off the river is just a spectacular picture. Now, did Travis take that picture?
Yes, he did. And what you think is a reflection is some of that is a hiking and biking path that goes separate from the highway, and it goes right next to the water. It's a 13-mile canyon. When I was younger, my wife and I went to a rafting trip down the Grand Canyon, Colorado River. And this is the closest I ever came to that experience.
And it looks like this large 6x3-foot poster is basically just blow-ups of some of the pages in the book to give people an idea, not just of the glory of the pictures, but also the text involved. So, and I also enjoyed the Bear Mountain Bridge, which I've driven across here, across the Hudson River.
Yeah.
And just from my personal standpoint, is that shooting east?
Yes.
Yeah. See,
shooting west.
Oh, it is, because the road actually splits off there.
Yeah.
Oh, and then right down here at the bottom of the poster, there's the page on Willimantic. The title says, "The Frogs That Roared." And yes, you do have a picture of our Volkswagen-sized frogs on spools on the south end of the Thread City Crossing Frog Bridge, with some of the American Thread Company mills just behind that. And you did an entire page, because Willimantic is part of Route 6, even though this particular location is on Route 66. Route 6 is now the highway bypass that goes
Correct.
By to the north. So I guess a few times you took a little artistic freedom, a little liberties with where you were actually on Route 6, right?
I tried to stay on the traditional Route 6. I'm betting that this 66 was at one time Route 6 before that highway was in there. And there's a lot of other places like that in the western side of the state. Route 6 is 6 and 84. Well, I'm not walking on the highways, but I found a road that used to be Route 6 and kind of parallels, goes up and down and over. And I should mention that the Willimantic is, in the programs I give, is almost always one of the things I mention. It's in a section that I call Close to Home, some really interesting things close to home. So when I'm doing talks in New England, I will mention Willimantic and show that picture and that sort of thing.
Well,
as
Joe,
I go through the book.
Can't begin to tell how many times I get asked about the story of why frogs and Willimantic and Windham and all that stuff. Well, you've got the David Haynes version here, and you've also got the pictures of the frogs on spools. You began your walk in March of 2004.
Oh, you're sneaky.
You know where this is going. And I suspect that probably in late March, maybe early April now, you've made the trek from Provincetown to Willimantic, USA. Yet your picture of the frogs on spools show them with that red scarf around them. They do that in December, not in March, Joe. What's the deal?
Oh, I think they were just late that year. No, what happened is as we were going through Connecticut, the photographer got called on to jury duty. He was not with me in photographer and driver. So my wife had to drive me through most of Connecticut. and we had no pictures of Connecticut. So when we, and which was okay, we made it through. I wrote stories for a dozen newspapers as we were walking, and we just did the best we could with what we had on those weeks. We didn't have many pictures. But when it came time to do the book, we said, you know, there's some stories in Connecticut that we really need pictures for. So we went back, I would say, about a year or two ago and did those pictures.
I was intrigued also about Foster, Rhode Island, a town on Route 6 that many of us have passed through, few of us stopping on our way to Providence or Cape Cod or places like that. But you, on your walk, found an auctioneer in Foster, Rhode Island.
Yeah. I would have thought that most of you people were familiar with that. I guess not. But that's one of the
maybe
things.
They are. I'm not. Yeah. Well, I drive by it.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things, as we mentioned before, that the difference between driving and walking, you get to see things that you don't see on wheels.
To just give a brief summary of the auction that they have in Foster, Rhode Island.
It has everything. I was blown away. I haven't been to an auction since I was a little kid, actually. Bought a Hopalong Cassidy book. I think when we were there, they were doing bales of hay. They have different days for household goods. They have days for pets and animals. They do snakes and things like that. It was a fascinating place.
Yeah, well, I just skip through Connecticut a little bit here, but you've got pictures and stories of the American Clock and Watch Museum in Bristol, the Willimantic Page, the Mark Twain House in Hartford. And then page Connecticut Time Machine, South Killington to Danbury. In fact, let's talk about that a little bit because of the whole Rochambeau thing. And we've actually had two different events where they recreated Rochambeau's March. And you've talked about that here as it goes through Southbury, Connecticut on Route 6.
Yeah, well, one of the things I learned, more on the Internet than anything else during the walk was that Route 6 follows a path that the militias took during the Revolutionary War because the British were too strong down by the coast. So it does have an awful lot of history. Of course, Connecticut in itself has an awful lot of revolutionary history, but Route 6 is part of that. And I found the story of the Connecticut, she's a heroine, I forget her name now.
Prudence Crandall.
I found that a fascinating story. And on my walk across, I think the one that walked across Connecticut the first time, we actually stayed in the same house that she had stayed in.
Well, that's where I want to go next, and actually pertains to what I mentioned a moment ago about how some of the liberties, because technically she's not on Route 6. She's just off Route 6. She's on Route 14. Yeah. But you actually mentioned her. It says the Prudence Crandall Museum is also on the trail. Prudence turned a sedate section of the state into an inferno when she opened a school for black girls in the 1830s. Townspeople shunned her, stoned the school, and eventually set it on fire. The state passed a law banning the school, and Crandall was arrested when she wouldn't back down. Prudence eventually won a series of court battles and had the ultimate victory. She's now the official state heroine. I felt connected to her in a small way when I spent a night in the Brooklyn, Connecticut house where she stayed during the trial. It's another good local connection there. And then you've got Route 6, Hartford, and Danbury in the book before eventually having this great picture of a solitary musician on the Hudson in Peekskill. So you're walking Route 6. You're about ready to cross, I guess, the Bear Mountain Bridge. And there's this guy sitting on a bench in Peekskill playing a trumpet. That's just a coincidence? How did you get that picture?
You know what? I have no idea. Oh. I never saw that guy.
Oh, that's a Travis thing then,
Travis would sometimes go off on his own and take pictures. And those are his pictures. That's his work. That's his art. And sometimes it's a lot better than what I've seen, although I like to think that what I saw was better than his.
Joe Hurley.
But you did mention Brooklyn, and I did want to mention that. When I do my program, I always start in the beginning with a mention of this area of the state because we're talking about, as we did, about discovering the other side of the state and how I had seen places that I'd never seen.
Other side for you, because you're from Western Connecticut. We are the other side. That's what you're referring to here.
Well, you always are the other side.
Yes. we think of you as the other side, too. You know?
Oh, we're the rich side. That's what I found out. You folks think of us as the rich side, and I'm thinking, that ain't true for me.
We're the quiet corner, pal.
Yes.
You're going to talk about Brooklyn.
Yeah. The way I start a lot of the programs is I ask people, do they know where Brooklyn is? And, of course, all the hands go up. And I say, what about Scotland? and the hands go up, and I say, Brooklyn, Connecticut. Scotland, Connecticut. And, of course, all the hands go down. And we're in Connecticut, but these people don't know that. And that's a little example to them of how little we know about the rest of our state.
I'm sure you get this question a lot. It's a classic radio question for an interview for a book like this. But you walked 3,600 miles coast to coast, pretty much staying on Route 6 from the Atlantic to the Pacific. What part of the country or what event or what town or what story do you like the best of all the great stories in this book?
I get that question a lot, of course. And the answer always changes. I mean, Glenwood Canyon is almost always there. The most haunting place was Death Valley. Have you been to Death Valley? Or are you from California?
Drove by the southern part of it, never really got to the
central
part.
Spend some time there. Yeah. Next time you're in California, spend some time. It just never leaves you. You go and you just, it's in the back of your mind. And it's not that it's such a vast place. I had visions of it being a vast place and people died trying to cross. It's not. It's a narrow valley. The trouble is, there's mountains on both sides. You're in, baby, until you find a pass out.
Now, they have got the all-time, I just showed you our weather calendar here, and on that listing, it's now been officially changed from Libya to Death Valley. Death Valley has, or tied for, the warmest temperature ever recorded on the planet. You were there in December. So what was the weather like in Death Valley in December?
Not bad at all. I don't remember specifically what the weather is like.
It wasn't deathly hot.
Oh, no, not at all. The thing that struck me about Death Valley is they do a marathon that goes from Mount Whitney to Death Valley.
Which is the highest part in
Death Valley. Yeah, it's freezing cold.
Mount Whitney's the highest point in the lower 48.
Yes, and I'm sure California. It's really cold when they're running there. And I'm telling you, the mountains are huge. You go over the Panamint Mountains to get out of Death Valley toward Mount Whitney. And we talked about a little bit about the car breaking down. What broke on the car was the brakes. And we found that out going down the Panamint Mountains into Death Valley. Thank God for low gear. Because there's a lot of switchbacks. It's probably 15 miles downhill. At least it felt that way.
But you were walking, not driving.
Oh, no, this was driving. This is going into Death Valley. There were several places. You talked about Prudence Crandall being off Route 6. Well, we went into Rocky Mountain National Park. That's off, way off. We went into Arches, way off. And we went into Death Valley, way off. As a matter of fact, the plan was to walk into Death Valley and walk back out, but we didn't have enough time, so we were going to drive, and we almost didn't make that.
Hey, you know what I enjoyed? The picture of the Plains Motel, where they actually put your names on their motel marquee. How'd you arrange that?
Oh, we didn't. It just happened. As I said, when we were going someplace where they knew we were coming, they treated us very well. But somewhere very near there, I'm going to try to find it, is one of my absolute most... you asked about the places I like best. There's this place called the Pioneer Village. There it is. It's on page 155. And you'll do better at describing these things than I do. But it's this guy who invented plastic wrap. Just saw the world was disappearing, so he decided to save things, sort of like a Noah's Ark. And he had saved everything from bicycles to cars to bobby pins. He has a building that has nothing but refrigerators and stoves from the earliest to the modern, and same thing with cars. There's 15 buildings in all. It's a great place.
Inadvertently, even as you went along your walk, the book has some themes in it, including an energy theme, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And to tell you the truth, I didn't realize there was no intention to do these themes. And I realized that there was an energy theme last night when I was preparing to talk with you. There's stories on coal, of course, in Pennsylvania, where we actually go down into a coal mine. And then there's one thing I didn't realize before the walk, but Pennsylvania was the home of oil in the United States for a long time until they discovered oil in Texas. It's the first oil well, of course, is in Pennsylvania, and of course oil is is there in Pennsylvania. Wind, we saw windmills in Pennsylvania. There's a windmill museum, small, the old-fashioned windmills out in Indiana. And then as you get out west, you begin to see the bigger ones, especially the windmill farms out in California. And then there's a story of one that they have in Indiana also.
The figures. Well, and I'm looking for the one right now. I haven't found it yet.
That's the one
you're
looking
for. But
you've
got that giant wind turbine. And when you look at it, you say, oh, I've seen
Bowling
wind
Green.
Turbines before.
Bowling Green.
Which happens to be where your photographer went to college. But the great thing about that picture is the caption, which points out the fact that there's people at the bottom of it. Could you say, oh, I've seen wind turbines? But then when you notice, when your eyes are drawn to the people, you realize, oh, my God, that's a huge wind turbine. You know, the people look minuscule at the bottom of that page. And another theme in your book, maybe inadvertently, water.
Yeah. Let me go back to the energy just a little more, because this
sure.
is kind of current news, but this was 6 years ago when I was going out west, and they have a lot of shale. And they were just starting to do fracking, long before any of us heard the term. And people were upset about it because they started doing fracking at, you know, once every 3 acres or so, and then they were down to like one well every, you know, eighth of an acre. They were very concerned, and it's just a very cautionary tale that you really have to have these things regulated.
And then onto the water thing.
Onto the water. The one of the most fascinating things is the Ogallala Reservoir, which covers western United States from, I think, almost to the Canadian border down to Texas, and it goes east and west for a very long way. It's why we have productive grain fields in the Midwest. If they had been able to access that water in the 1930s, we would not have had the great drought and depression in the 1930s. But they weren't able to. Unfortunately, now that we've got the ability to access that water, we're pumping it out at a rate that would have drained the Ogallala Reservoir within 50 years. So they're putting some restrictions on it, but we're still taking out more than is going into the reservoir. And that's over in Nebraska and Iowa and Colorado, those areas. In Colorado, they also have water from the Rockies, and they're getting less and less snowmelt every year, combined with more and more demand from the cities that use the Rockies water, such as Los Angeles. And they're having huge battles out there over water rights. And if you have a stream going by your house, you are not entitled to that water necessarily. You might be entitled to some small fraction of it, but you can't just take water from the streams anymore. And if you're walking down, as you're being a California guy, as you're familiar with, if you're coming down whatever road it is that goes by Owens Lake in the Owens Valley, there is no more lake. It's been drained.
That used to be where LA got its water from.
Yes, yeah.
And now they get it with aqueducts that come from other places, including the Colorado River.
Yeah, and as far away as the Rockies, yeah.
That's right. Going back to a topic we mentioned earlier, that we talked about how Main Street in Willimantic is now Route 66, but Bev York, who's quoted in your book on the Willimantic page here from the Mill Museum, she clarifies what we had said earlier, that Main Street was originally Route 6, and I thought about it, and actually what people may have forgotten about was that when the Route 6 expressway that bypassed Willimantic was first built in the 70s, it was designed to be I-84 to Providence, and then the people of Scituate Reservoir put a kibosh on that for reasons that still don't make sense to me. But during that period of time, they actually renamed what is now 84 from Hartford to Sturbridge 86. There were signs that said 86, and we had 84 going past Willimantic. And then when the Rhode Island thing hit the skids, then they renamed it. They put 84 back to what's now 84, and then they named Route 6. Route 6 was Main Street Willimantic, and then they made it the bypass, and now Main Street is Route 66. So technically, if you came through Willimantic and saw the Frog Bridge and the rest of Willimantic that you did see, you were on a street that was Route 6 back in the day.
Yes, the old Route 6. That's what I tried to do in all cases.
Tell me about Dawn, your daughter.
Dawn. I'm more proud of what she's doing than anything I've ever done in my life. She was living in the Congo. Her husband was working for World Relief. And she saw these women carrying what amounts to boulders on their head. And they were carrying them. They would get a couple of pennies for carrying these boulders from a construction site to someplace else or to a construction site. And she thought, there has to be a better way for these women. So she started a sewing group. And they made things like purses and clothing and other such things. She started selling them when she came back to the U.S. And now it's evolved into a situation where she has handicapped women. These are women who in the Congo would have been at the lowest rung of society, dependent on other people for their sustenance, etc. And now it has totally reversed with the, with these things that she's selling. They've managed to build their own building. These women who were reliant on their extended family now have built houses and bring their extended family in. They are the stars of the family, even though they're handicapped. And she loves this section of the state. She said, it's beautiful out there. You should see it, Joe. And I said, well, I've been there. And that's why I'm coming to the fair. I wanted to be with her. But it's a really inspiring story for me.
Joe Hurley, a retired newspaper reporter who spent most of his career at the News Times in Danbury, where he wrote, among other things, the consumer humor column called Shallow Pockets. Full disclosure here, Joe, when you took this cross-country walk in 2004, how old were you when you did it?
I turned 60 on the walk.
Any special celebration for that event?
I don't think so. Travis is, we're two guys on a trip. We're not blowing out candles.
Well, I tell you what, I do authors a lot here, and there's a lot of books I like. I really just fell in love with this book. Combination of the narrative that goes with it that you wrote and the tremendous pictures. A lot of people are never going to get a chance to do the drive across country or the walk across country, but this gives you a feeling for what this country is all about. 10 million steps on Route 6, subtitled A Fresh Look at America and Americans from Cape Cod to California. Information on the web, which we also link on our morning show guest page on our website. You can go to Route6Walk.com. That's the number 6 between the words Route and Sick, Route and Walk, all one word, Route6Walk.com. And his email for more information, japhurley@hotmail.com. He'd love to hear from you. And I really recommend this book because I think it's a great piece of journalism. Joe, thanks for the long drive from New Milford this morning, and best of luck. And hopefully there's not only these books on the horizon somewhere down the road.
Well, thank you very much. This is one of the better interviews I've done.
Oh, no, it was the best one you did.
All right, okay. I think that's probably true.